Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, the National Museum of the United States Air Force has selected their Volunteer of the Year. Jim Blackman of Beaver Creek will talk to him about that honor, and we'll speak with Bonnie Holtman, who runs the volunteer program for the museum. We'll take you on another road trip, this time along Ohio's Route 33 in Meigs County. Ellen Belcher has this week's Politics Ohio up first. The Governor's Awards for the Arts in Ohio is a statewide program that showcases and celebrates Ohio artists, arts organizations, arts patrons, and businesses in support of the arts. Winners are selected in six categories. I am pleased to be sitting with the winner of the 2012 Individual Artist, the Governor's Award, Michael Bashaw, a longtime performance artist here in Dayton. Michael, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
The awards ceremony was held just a couple of weeks ago, correct?
Yeah, it was a great day. It was a beautiful day. My daughters came in from South Carolina, joined Sandy and Katie and I. Katie's my stepdaughter, and Sandy's my wife and partner, creative partner. And we had a lovely trip up to Columbus. And I don't know, the event was, I think it was attended by over 800 people. You know, the thing moved along quickly, and the longer I sat there, the more nervous I got. Because I had to give a speech. So,
oh, yeah.
For me personally, it was a surprise. You know, I really didn't expect to get it, but it validates the work that I've done over the years. And I think a big part of why I was given the award, part of it had to do with performance. A big part of it had to do with the way I've blended sculpture and music. And also, I think the education aspect of my work, because I've done residencies in schools for years. A lot of that's been done through the Muse Machine, which had a huge impact on my career. Since the late 1980s, I've been working as a contract artist with Muse Machine, and I think that was looked at pretty seriously as well.
It's been, as you said, a big part of your body of work, education. Mm-hmm. And tell me a little bit about your philosophy of passing on your knowledge of the arts and teaching that to new generations.
Over the years, I think one of the things that I've come to realize is that people like to feel like they're a part of something larger than themselves. Kids like to feel like they're a part of something, and they get excited about doing something that might take on a monumental scale even. So if it's a visual piece, and some of my work is musical, some of it's visual, some of it's combined. But if it's a visual piece, what I like to do is find ways that I can create works that involve components that individual students can create. And then when we put the whole thing together, it can make a really grand statement. And a lot of these works are in the schools now, in the Dayton Public Schools in particular. And they're there for the kids to see every day and take pride in.
Let's talk about some of your current work that's underway. You are providing music for a number of efforts underway, one of which is a documentary called Take Us Home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Take Us Home is a documentary that was created by Eileen LeBlanc. It was written and directed by Eileen and produced along with the Levin Family Foundation. Was a major funder in that endeavor. And it has to do with the transporting of the Ethiopian Jews from Ethiopia to Israel. It's about the airlift. And it's really a story of immigration, a story of loss and new life, the struggle primarily three families go through, but also all those Ethiopian Jews who gave up so much in order to go to Israel. And it's a beautifully shot film. Mike King did the cinema photography. And I think Eileen and Mike went to Ethiopia and Israel at least five times. It's a beautiful film. And I think it speaks to a lot of what's going on today. What do people go through in order to immigrate? What do they give up? What do they gain? And if you go to a new place, what do you have to go through in order to adapt or assimilate into the culture? And so it addresses all those things.
And so when you approach a project like that, do you incorporate those themes? Do you sit and think about sacrifice and giving up one's home or relocating immigration? Do you take those themes and just try to transpose that into music?
Well, yeah. The process that that Sandy and I go through with Eileen is primarily one in which she'll talk about the emotion of a certain scene, or if she has clips, she'll show us the clips. And then we'll start working out ideas, and we'll send them to Eileen. She'll just say, yeah, that sounds good, but can you do this or can you do that? Can you change this or that? And so there's a real give and take. And the thing about Eileen is I think we have our own vocabulary when we work with Eileen and try to create music for her. She'll admit that she doesn't know a lot about the technical aspects of music, but somehow we're able to communicate. She's able to communicate what she needs, and we're able to give it to her. But there is a lot of give and take, trial and error. And in this case, it was over a four-year process. A lot of what she does is try to edit to the music rather than create the scene, use temp scores, and then try to find the music to fit it. She likes to have the music first and edit to it. And I think Martin Scorsese works that way too. We have the utmost respect for Eileen. She really knows how to tell a story, and I think she really delivered on this film. That particular piece of music was used to signify a certain character in his family. That character's name is Alalin, and so this piece was used in the airport scene in Israel. So we tried to capture a certain feeling with the music that represented the idea of loss but also new life.
You're also providing music for another project that Eileen has been involved in herself, the Ohio History Tour. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, I think that's funded by the Humanities Council. And we did the music for one selection called Bicycles to Moon Launch. It has to do with invention in Ohio and the significance of Dayton and the Wright brothers, as well as Air Force Museum and Neil Armstrong. And there's also another section, another tour about the cross tip churches up in Mercer County. And so we created music for that. And we selected a 15th century pilgrim song called Stella Splendens. And that's the music we use for that particular journey. So.
Music from Michael and Sandy Bashall. Michael, thanks again for coming in. Michael has won the Individual Artist Governor's Award for 2012, and we're talking about current projects that you have. You're also working on a piece for the Salem Avenue Corridor as part of the Phoenix Project. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this is a sculpture commission. It's a project for City of Dayton and Phoenix Project, and it's administered through Citywide Development. The sculpture's twofold. The purpose is to define the entrance into City of Dayton. It's on land that was once the Troutman Studios, the legendary Troutman Studios. Roger Troutman and his brothers created an amazing amount of work out of that location, and basically in the funk and R&B genres. But this is kind of a memorial to Roger, as well as a symbolic piece that represents the Dayton View Triangle.
And you also took part in the UD Art Series 50th anniversary season?
Yeah, that was really great. For me, it was a great collaboration with So Percussion out of Brooklyn, New York. They're amazing musicians, really innovative, and they spearheaded a resurgence in the new music scene in New York. So to work with them on this project, along with students from Dayton Early College Academy, it was a real treat. They came in to town and January, we did some rehearsals up in my studio, and it was a sound sculpture concert. The intention was to make it a sound sculpture concert. And so we did some rehearsals with the kids from DECA, and so and I did some rehearsals of their pieces, and then they worked on some of our pieces. And then they came back in the spring, and we did 3 days of rehearsals and then did the concert. So there was a real nice openness about it. And, you know, we knew it was in order to really pull the concert off, we had to be open to improvisation. So, and it was held at the Dayton Art Institute, and it was a really great, great turnout. We had a full house, and the night was a real success. We all felt good about it.
You've had the chance to collaborate with a lot of artists over the years.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about the difference between working individually and working with other artists.
Yeah, that the one of the things that I guess getting this award caused me to do is reflect a lot. And when I think back on my career, I think about all the musicians and visual artists and poets and dancers that I've had the chance to work with. It's just in each case, it's a different kind of collaboration. But I've learned so much, and I think that's for me that's been the most significant part of my whole career, is learning and growing. Once I chose the path to work as a freelance artist, everybody I've worked with over the years has taught me a lot. That's been my main education, and I'm still learning.
Well, I think that it's safe to say many of our listeners would agree that you and Sandy are really true Dayton gems for the arts and the music that you've provided over the years. So congratulations on the 2012 Governor's Award for Individual Artist, and just thanks.
Thank you, Jerry. Glad to be here.
If there's an art to traveling, it can be found in this week's Road Trip, a weekly feature where radio producers from around the state take you on a different audio tour as part of the new Ohio Guide. This week, we'll explore Ohio's Route 33 in Meigs County.
Hi, I'm Sandra Sleiprennen, and for this Road Trip tour, you'll be traveling with me. This part of Meigs County has seen over 150 years of extractive industries. They left scars that are just now beginning to heal. Some Meigs County residents are looking for more sustainable ways to use the land. One of them is Paul Strauss. Over 40 years ago, he left New York City and bought 80 acres near the Meigs County town of Rutland.
There's 200 acres in this high wall right in here. My farm was never stripped, and you know, but all this was. This is the old Mac Cumber farm. Mr. Mac Cumber sold his coal for 15 cents a ton. Amos, I lived on the old Amos farm, met the bulldozers and the strippers with a shotgun, said, "You are not stepping across this line. Here's a guy I never met I have to love."
Strauss bought more land, some of it the old McCumber farm. As an herbalist, he was amazed at what he found here.
You get out a map, find Charleston, West Virginia, and you just extend it in any direction up 200 miles, that is the most varied and valuable deciduous forest in America. I think that's lost on a lot of people.
This area, Strauss says, is the heart of Appalachia. In these woods, there are more species of trees and shrubs, the big herbs, than almost any area of this country or the world.
So, I suppose you're ready to walk 2 miles, right?
Strauss and other like-minded folks created nonprofit United Plant Savers and donated land in Meigs County for a 380-acre botanical sanctuary for native medicinal plants.
That brown pine over there, I have some of that in my woods, too.
That indicates a drier soil. That's responsible for our coal.
Now they've created the Talking Forest Medicine Trail, 8 miles of trails with signs to identify the herbs and the shrubs and the trees and their uses. One December day, I walked the trail with him.
Redbud, young American elm, white snakeroot.
That's a famous plant. Not for what it does, but what it did. That's the plant that was responsible for Abraham Lincoln's mother's death.
Really?
Yeah.
United Plant Savers think that just being able to identify the plants isn't enough. People need to know how you can use them and what they do.
It's an Asteraceae, so, you know, it's a common plant. White snakeroot milk fever. If a milk cow eats an abundance of this plant and you drink the milk, you're dead. And that's what happened to his mother.
Wow.
And that's the plant.
United Plant Savers hope that here they can protect many native Appalachian medicinal plants. So far, over 500 species of plants, 120 species of trees, and 200 species of fungi have been identified. The sanctuary is a living model for protecting diversity and ensuring that the rich traditions of North American and Euro-American folk medicine continue to survive.
So it's important that this land is here for the sanctity of the earth. You know that they're not going to mess with it. You can come and see these plants exactly like they were a million years ago, exactly like the native people were using them.
I promise it will forever change the way you look at a forest. Black Haw.
Yeah, now that tree talked through the first chemical warfare in the world.
From Rutland, Ohio, I'm Sandra Slight-Brennan.
You can download the New Ohio Guide Tours at seeohiofirst.org. The New Ohio Guide is produced by the Ohio Humanities Council, a state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Welcome to Politics Ohio. I'm Ellen Belcher, filling in for Emily McCord. I'm talking to George Voinovich, former two-term U.S. Senator, former two-term governor, and former mayor of Cleveland for 10 years. It's great to have you on the line, Senator Voinovich.
Well, I'm glad to come on the line with you, Ellen.
Thank you. You're 75. You've been out of office now a year and a half, but you're still very much involved in public policy debates. You recently told Joe Hallett of the Columbus Dispatch that you were hopeful that Congress may take historic action to rein in the federal budget after the election. I think that's the first time I've heard you say you're hopeful about the country's debt problem. What's up?
Well, I'm on the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. That's the group that's working with Ellen Simpson and Erskine Bowles. They headed up the president's commission, and unfortunately, the president should have supported their recommendations and didn't. The hope is that we can get something done in the lame duck session. If they don't do anything, the Bush tax cuts are going to evaporate, and the sequester of $600 billion in defense spending are going to go into effect. My feeling is they ought to forget about the Bush tax cuts, forget about the sequester, and just start from scratch, reform the tax code, and deal with our entitlements.
When you were in Washington, what did you hear from senators or members of Congress that made you feel like this is a possibility, that there might be the will to take this on? What were they saying to you?
They have to do something during the lame duck. There's enough information and there's enough concern that if we don't do what we call go big, in other words, go for a $6 trillion package that spread out over a number of years with enforcement mechanisms and really do what is intellectually honest, and everyone who watches will say that's an intellectually honest accomplishment, and I think we have a shot.
Last year about this time, you said that your choice for president was Indiana Governor Mitch Daniels. What do you think about Mitt Romney?
I was one of the earliest people in the country to support Mitt Romney. After Mitch decided not to do it, I met with Romney, and so I've been impressed. If he can do for America what he did for Bain, if he can do for America what he did at the Olympics, and he did a decent job as governor of Massachusetts, I think he's a decent man, he's a smart man, and I think he'll be a good president.
Given that the whole deficit thing is your issue, and you've opposed the Bush tax cuts and Governor Romney supports them, why isn't that a deal breaker for you?
I don't know if he really does.
Well, that's an interesting observation. What does that mean?
Look, we've got some really solid people. The Gang of Six, and they're real conservative guys. On the Democratic side, we had Ken Conrad and a couple of others. They have done an enormous amount of work. If they can handle this, think of what a relief it's going to be for him that whole issue is going to be over.
Let's talk about the Ohio Senate race that's on the ballot this year. Senator Sherrod Brown, a liberal Democrat, is being challenged by Ohio's Republican State Treasurer Josh Mandel. What do you think about the two candidates?
Well, I know them both, and I just think that it's going to be a good opportunity for Ohioans to decide, are they more liberal or are they more conservative?
Recently, a friend of yours, U.S. Senator Richard Lugar of Indiana, was defeated. 6 years ago, he was the only Republican senator in the country to run without Democratic opposition. This time around, Senator Lugar, who's 80, was bumped off by a Tea Party candidate who criticized him for being insufficiently conservative. You came to criticize President Bush's execution of the Iraq War. You crossed the aisle to vote with Democrats to oppose tax cuts in the face of the deficit, and you supported extending unemployment benefits. If you were on the ballot this year, would Ohioans find you insufficiently conservative?
I didn't support President Obama's stimulus. I didn't support his health care plan. I call myself a common sense conservative. And in the case of the Bush tax cut, he just wanted too much money. Can you imagine if he'd got the $1 billion tax cut that he wanted? And as you know, we've held out and held out and held out. Got it down to $350 billion. And quite frankly, as I look back, see all of the costs of the wars, that even that at that time I think was too much. We do have some people out there that I think are well-meaning people, but I don't think they're sophisticated enough to know that there really aren't easy answers to these complicated problems that we have, and they don't understand that in order to get something done, once you're elected, you have to work with the other side to come up with a compromise or a consensus so you can move the country forward.
I've been talking with former Senator George Voinovich. Thanks so much for your time, Senator.
It was nice to talk with you too, Ellen.
You're listening to WISO Weekend on WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks for joining us. Jim Blackman is a retired Air Force officer living in Beaver Creek with his wife. He has two grown daughters. Recently, Jim received the 2011 Director's Award for Volunteer of the Year at the National Museum of the United States Air Force. He received the honor for his dedication and excellence in serving the museum and the U.S. Air Force. Their expansive volunteer program just celebrated its 30th anniversary by honoring Jim and more than 500 volunteers at a banquet in April. Jim's day involves monitoring the museum's galleries, serving and transporting customers. He also serves on the Advisory Council of Volunteers. Next year, he'll serve as its chair. The museum keeps him busy, but he found a few minutes to sit down and talk about his job and about being named Volunteer of the Year.
Well, I was very surprised and humbled to receive the award. You know, we have over 500 volunteers here at the museum, and every one of them has a unique level of contribution. I've been volunteering for nearly 5 years at this point.
What drew you to the museum?
My personal story is I was in the Air Force for 37 years, and that's a long time. And when I did retire from military service, it was quite frankly a way for me to stay connected and stay involved and to stay in an area which I had great interest and great love, and it's worked out quite well. I think I get more out of it than I give.
And so let's talk about some of your favorite activities as a volunteer.
I think, if I can almost speak for every volunteer, and our most enjoyable thing is interacting with the public when they come in. For us to be able to, whether we're talking about Air Force history, the Air Force present, our education programs in STEM, or just visiting about where you're from and where you're headed to, I think that is without a doubt the most fun experience we have.
On a day like today, you've got crowds of kids and people enjoying the museum. How does that experience feel for you?
I particularly love to volunteer on days when it's busy that I think we kind of pick up on the energy level that's here. And when you get a crowd of, on a good day, you'll have older visitors, perhaps veterans of conflicts long ago, their children, their grandchildren. Particularly see a lot of young families coming out and youth groups. We see Boy Scouts, schools, junior ROTC, Civil Air Patrol. It's like you say, we do pick up on that energy quite a bit.
As a 5-year volunteer here at the museum, you would recommend the experience for anyone interested in volunteering?
Absolutely, and I want to point out for sure, you do not have to be a military veteran, an Air Force veteran. You do not have to be an older person. Any person that has an interest in coming out here and helping and learning, you'll be taught what you need to know, and you'll enjoy it when you do come out.
Jim Blackman, thanks.
Thank you very much for coming out here and let us tell our story a little bit.
Volunteers like Jim are guided by Bonnie Holtman. She's the manager of volunteer resources for the museum. We got a few minutes of her time as well.
We do have over 500 volunteers, and it seems like each time we have added a new hangar to this complex, it's been my job to bring in about 150 new volunteers to support that. We have volunteers that work in teams in each one of the galleries, and they're in teams of 3 or 4 per shift, 2 shifts a day, so you start doing the math, and that's quite a number of volunteers. We need about 40 volunteers a day to keep the museum operating the way that we need to.
And you probably need volunteers to coordinate the volunteers.
That would be me. That would be me, and I have been here in this position since 1986. So I took the program over when we had about 100 loose volunteers on a piece of paper, and we've grown it 5 times fold. So very pleased with the longevity. Jim has been here for 5 years. We had one of the volunteers at our recent awards banquet who was given a 35-year award. So it seems like once they come, unless something in life gets in their way that they have to move or they have to surrender their activity here, they seem to stick and they seem to like it really well.
Well, it does speak well for an organization when you do have long-term volunteers like that.
We don't expect every volunteer to be here 35 years, but we do have a little bit of a different program than most volunteer programs in that we have a serious-minded storyline that we tell, and we draw a lot of retired teachers, a lot of history buffs, and as Jim said, a lot of people who have been with the military and around the military for a great portion of their life. And the number one reason that they come back here is to either keep in touch with their career field or they want to give back to their community.
And so how do you assess the volunteer needs on a daily, weekly, monthly, or even longer-term basis? I know you've got some new grants that are coming in. You're thinking about a fourth facility with some new displays, I think. So what are your assessments of the future for volunteer needs?
Well, it seems like we're going to need about 150 new volunteers to support our new space gallery. And when that is up, some of our current volunteers, such as Jim, may choose to work back there. So they'll scatter around to the new location. So we'll need 150 to fill in those vacancies or to also work back there, depending on their interests and where they would like their assignments. We actually do more. We have different kinds of positions and have more opportunities in the museum, in addition to our gallery monitors, which, of course, is very, very important to our daily operation. But we have some of our divisions and some of our technical shops that also are dependent on volunteers. One of our proudest groups would be the restoration volunteers, and we have 60 retired volunteers. They donate a minimum of 1 day a week. They must have proven career skills in the areas that restoration needs done and helps us to address our backlog of aircraft restoration over there. We also have a very large number of education volunteers. We have a lot of education programs here on a monthly basis, and it takes a lot of volunteers to run the size of the programs and events that they schedule. So we're very dependent on volunteers. They've spoiled us very much.
And do your education volunteers serve as docents for the displays, or do they have more formal structured classes?
They do both. We have a monthly family day program, and the more volunteers we can drum up for that day, the more they can offer. I have been told by one of the aerospace educators that they can't have enough volunteers, so just keep them coming in her door, and she'll be glad to make assignments for them to make successful family days once a month. And then we have workshops. We have some of the schools will come, and they will request a specific theme of study. And so the volunteers will go into the learning center, and they will introduce them to those areas of history and possibly do some activities that coincide with that.
And so what are the general requirements for anyone interested in volunteering? Certainly time is an issue. And what other skills are you looking for?
A lot of times we have created jobs based on some of the skills that people have brought in the door. One example of that would be we were approached by our collections division staff, and they were looking for people who could sew because we needed some components prepared for our space suit exhibits. And we've had folks, for example, that have foreign language speaking abilities. So it's a back and forth component of how we schedule and how we place and how sometimes volunteers actually place themselves by the talents that they have. On a side note, I wanted to boast about some of our volunteers that travel here from a long distance. On a monthly basis, we have volunteers that come to us from Indiana, Illinois, Kentucky, West Virginia, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Nebraska. So that, to me, is pretty overwhelming, and they do so every month.
So anyone interested in volunteering with the museum, how should they proceed?
One of our best ways is to go to our website, and they will find all kinds of information, and they will also find a way that they can request a packet of information be sent to them that will include the paperwork necessary to enter. We do require 2 4-hour shifts per month.
Bonnie Holtman, Manager of Volunteer Resources at the National Museum of the United States Air Force, thanks also for speaking with us today.
I'm delighted to meet you and very thankful that you came to interview our new Volunteer of the Year, Jim Blackman, and it was nice speaking with you today.
That's it for this week's edition of WISO Weekend. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks to all our guests, and thank you for listening to member-supported 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, a broadcast service of Antioch University for the Miami Valley. Coming up next on WYSO, The Book Nook.